Hello, welcome to episode, 42 of the Rocky Mountain Mason podcast. Today, when I'm recording this, it's January 25th. January 25th, you say. Why could that be significant? Well, as every good proper Mason knows, that be Robert Burns' birthday. That's right, happy birthday to Robbie Burns, the poet laureate of Freemasonry. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, gosh, if it wasn't 2021, and we weren't in the midst of this ongoing pandemic, I might be getting ready to put on my kilt and go enjoy a few wee drams with my brethren in Masonry. Robbie Burns was a proud member of the Enlightenment, a real lover, a good man, popular, well-loved by all, and quite talented. May his memory ever live on in our gentle craft. So today, I'm going to read to you a brief biography of Robert Burns, and then, if you're a good boy, I might read to you my toast to Robert Burns, delivered first in Grand Junction, and then at Acacia Lodge in Wyoming. I must beg your forgiveness for my Scottish accent. Well, hello. Today, when I'm recording this, it is January 25th. That's the birthday of Robert Burns, the poet laureate of Freemasonry. Now, you'll be listening to this a few days later, probably on the 27th, but nonetheless, happy birthday, Robert Burns. Typically, in any normal season, any normal year, Masonic lodges around the globe would be preparing for their annual Robert Burns feasts. This probably goes back to our claims of Scottish descendancy for the so-called higher degrees and the Battle of Bannockburn and the Knights Templars who famously showed up to help Robert the Bruce defeat the King of England, etc., etc. Nonetheless, Robert Burns is a wonderful poet and a wonderful mind of the Enlightenment. And he well, I think, surmises the conviviality of brotherhood and embodies the gentle soul that behooves us all, in some capacities at least, to emulate. So I thought I would read to you a brief biography of Robert Burns that I put together to give at a Robert Burns feast back in the day. And then I thought I would end with my toast to Robert Burns. So if you'll join with me in a wee dram, this of course will in no wise make up for your absence at some Burns Table Lodge, which we must forgo this year. But nonetheless, I hope with a raising of the wrist, it might at least make the present months a wee more palatable. So Robert Burns, the Bard of Scotland, was born January 25th in 1759 to poor parents in Alloway, South Ayrshire, Scotland. He was educated primarily by his father, a tenant farmer. His early years were hard and found him laboring in the fields. Yet this would not stop his artistic gift from flourishing. He remains one of the most celebrated poets of Scotland, with an enduring name throughout the world. He studied Latin, French, and grammar for just a few years under John Murdoch. The rest of his education was pure inspiration. He was an active Freemason. He was initiated into Lodge St. David Tarbolton, Kilwinning number 135, on July 4th, 1781, and raised to the sublime degree of a Master Mason on October 1st, 1781. He was elected Deputy Master in 1785, and he initiated and passed his own brother, Gilbert Burns, into the rites. In 1787, at the Lodge of St. Andrew in Edinburgh, he was toasted by the Grand Master of Scotland, Francis Charteris, and proclaimed the Poet Laureate of the Lodge, a distinction he still enjoys today as the Poet Laureate of all Freemasonry. Burns wrote in the Scotch language, and also in English with a Scotch dialect. His poetry, inspired by romantic ideals, has since been popular anywhere people struggle for equality. The first country to commemorate him with a postage stamp was Russia in 1956. He was a likable chap, witty, extemporaneous, and endowed with many talents, not least of which seems to be wooing the fairer sex. His first child, Elizabeth Peyton Burns, 1785 to 1817, was the result of his affair with his mother's servant, Elizabeth Peyton, and this while he was actively courting Jean Armour, a daughter of a Freemason from Mauchline. Jean would become pregnant the very next year, in 1786, with twins. Despite resistance from Jean's father, who tried to have him incarcerated, Burns married her in 1788. Theirs was a large family. They had 9 children, although only 3 survived infancy. However, he had by this time already fallen in love with Mary Campbell, to whom he would write several poems. There is some evidence he had planned to take her to Jamaica with him, where he'd been offered a bookkeeping job. His song, "Will Ye Go to the Indies, My Mary, and Leave Old Scotia's Shore," seems to testify to this fact. In 1786, after his first volume of poems received critical acclaim, he borrowed a horse and rode up to Edinburgh. The time he spent there was perhaps the most formative period of his poetry, and also his masonry. Walter Scott, who he met there, described his talents as, and I quote, "extraordinary," and wrote that he had never seen such glowing eyes, though I have seen the most distinguished men of my time, said Scott. In Edinburgh, Burns met Agnes Nancy McLehose and wooed her with his pen. It seems she was not willing to consummate their relationship in a physically expedient manner, so he directed his attentions to Jenny Clough, Nancy's servant, who bore him a son in 1788. His relationship with Nancy did not come to an end, though, until 1791, when she embarked to Jamaica to find her estranged husband, his "I Fond Kiss" was penned for her. Burns's legacy is long-lasting and profound. Among the many people he has influenced are John Steinbeck, J.D. Salinger, and Bob Dylan. The title work, Of Mice and Men, comes from the line, "The blessed laid schemes of mice and men, gang after glay," from Burns's To a Mouse. Bob Dylan apparently cited Burns's "A Red, Red Rose" as the lyric which most affected his life. William Wordsworth, Samuel Coleridge, and Shelley found themselves in good company when reading Burns. And this happy fact is easily witnessed at the hundreds of Burns dinners held every year around his birthday, today, brethren, January 25th. In 2009, Scottish Television polled the Scottish public as to who should be named the greatest Scot. After a series of programs on the subject, on St. Andrew's Day, Scottish Television announced the winner, Robert Burns. He was voted as the greatest Scot of all time, beating the likes of William Wallace, whose struggles against the British in the 13th and early 14th century marked the epitome of Scottish independence. Burns died at the young age of 37, after a dental extraction, which sounds horrible. His failing health had likely stemmed from his dissolute lifestyle. He had a penchant for the whiskey to free his tongue and loose his pen. But a man more concerned with liberty, love, and humanity itself is hard to come by. "I murder hate by flood or field, though glory's name my screenus. In wars a home I'll spend my blood, life-giving wars of Venus. The deities that I adore are social peace and plenty, I'm better pleased to make one more than be the death of 20. That was from I Murder Hate by Robert Burns. Well, I hope you'll join with me to lift a glass and raise a toast in memory of the life of Robert Burns. A toast to Robert Burns. I'm proud to call ye brother Burns, e'en though ye do perplex me, for round about your tongue in turns, verily does vex me. Being a man of English birth, and born there of the gentry, when I hear your Scotty words, it's hard not to correct ye. Still, I suffer well for what it's worth, in love of poetry. You're a dastardly haggis-loving fool, a skirt-wearing Scottish Nancy. It's hard for me to keep me cool when your dialect gets fancy. Aye, Bobby lad, can I ken ye close, or must we e'er be apart? 'Cause truth, I swear I raise a toast to ye with all me art. Ye, brother, there's a language true that needs no words expressed. To mortar bricks and then to glue, mankind as brothers best. It takes not for the outward brood, and cares not how ye dressed. Obviously, you skirt-wearing pillock, but as one great brotherhood, loved by God and blessed, gloriously on Zion's hillock. It views the heart supreme, and weighs by scales of truth. I tell ye, Bobby lad, that I don't need the proof, unless it be 100-proof liquor, that a brother's love for your poor ghost can never see ye better. For in our hearts ye do have a place to haunt your merry fun. So I give ye small wink and smile, and lift you up my glass. And in your name I take a sip to praise your Scottish arse. So now, with a wee loving nod, and a rolling R from tongue, 'cause I may be a wee British lad, but tonight I'm all Scotsman. So thanks again, young Bobby lad, for letting us let our hairs down. And eating haggis ain't so bad, if you done ken where it come from. God bless ye, God bless ye, Bobby. May ye find eternal rest, ever wrapped up with your bonny lass, the one you loved the best. And yet I know there was more than one, so let me make amends. May heaven find ye in the arms of many women, and in the esteem of many friends. Aye, Bobby Burns, here's a toast for you, ye Scottish wag and your country brogue, 'cause really we love ye through and through, ye damnable Scottish rogue. From Roslyn down to Bannockburn, from Glasgow to Aberdeen, they'll sing your name at every turn, and at all the pubs between. They'll sing your name the whole night through to Bobby Burns. But I'll drink to St. Andrew. Now, I hope you understand, of course, that Robbie Burns would hopefully enjoy the gentle ribbing made in his direction in that toaster to Bobby Burns. He certainly didn't hold back against the British at every available opportunity, and with good reason, I hasten to add. Now, I have to apologize to any Scotsman that suffered through that rendition of my Scottish accent, and I apologize. I am actually, in fact, 14% Scottish. Believe it or not, I have quite a bit of Scottish blood. I've got a lot of Welsh blood too, and quite a bit of Irish. It turns out from Ancestry.com that I keep getting more Scottish, more and more. It started off about 7%, and I've doubled in Scotsness. I think it might be all that Macallan and Oban might be, you know, doing its work on my DNA. Anyway. So, we should move on to the three books of occult philosophy. If I am to stay with this project, Now, things are getting a little bit more interesting, so it would behoove me to keep going. I hope you're putting up with this okay. I realize this is a rather, you know, odd undertaking to read this sort of medieval book online. I don't remember where we are. I think we're on chapter 24, What Things Are Lunary or Under the Power of the Moon. Yes, I think that is where we are. I should add that although Robert Burns is obviously quite Venusian, and you probably heard his reference to Venus in his that excerpt from I Murder Hate that I read at the beginning of this episode, he's also quite lunary. I would well ascribe Robert Burns to a nice admixture of the moon and Venus. I'd put those two together and make a Robert Burns. So I think he might approve of reading chapter 24 on the three books of occult philosophy by Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa of von Nettesheim in his honor on his birthday. So Bobby, up there where you are, this is for you. Chapter 24 of the three books of occult philosophy by Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa von Nettesheim. What Things Are Lunary or Under the Power of the Moon? These things are lunary, amongst the elements, viz. The earth, then water, as well as that of the sea, as of the rivers, and all moist things, as the moisture of trees and animals, especially they which are white, as the whites of eggs, fat, sweat, phlegm, and the superfluities of bodies. Amongst tastes, salt and insipid, amongst metals, silver, amongst stones, crystal, the silver marcasite, and all those stones that are white and green, also the stone selenites, i.e. lunary shining from a white body with a yellow brightness, imitating the motion of the moon, having in it the figure of the moon, which daily increaseth or decreaseth, as doth the moon. Also pearls, which are generated in shells of fishes from the droppings of water. Also the beryl. Amongst plants and trees, these are lunary, as the selenotropion, which turns towards the moon, as doth the heliotropion towards the sun, and the palm tree sends forth a bough at every rising of the moon. Hyssop, also, and rosemary, agnus castus, and the olive tree are lunary. Also, the herb chinoster, which increaseth and decreaseth with the moon, viz. In substance and number of leaves, not only in sap and virtue, which indeed is in some sort common to all plants, except onions, which are under the influence of Mars, which have contrary properties, as amongst flying things the saturnine bird, called a quail, is a great enemy to the moon and sun. Lunary animals are such as delight to be in man's company, and such as do naturally excel in love or hatred, as all kinds of dogs. The chameleon also is lunary, which also assumes a colour according to the variety of colour of the object. As the moon changeth her nature according to the variety of the sign which it is found in, lunary also are swine, hinds, goats, and all animals whatsoever that observe and imitate the motion of the moon, as the baboon and panther, which is said to have a spot upon her shoulder like the moon, increasing into a roundness, and having horns that bend inwards. Cats also are lunary, whose eyes become greater or less according to the course of the moon. And those things which are of like nature, as menstruous blood, of which are made wonderful strange things by magicians. The civet cat also changing her sex, being obnoxious to diverse sorceries, and all animals that live in water as well as on land, as otters and such as prey upon fish. Also all monstrous beasts, such as without any manifest seed, are equivocally generated, as mice, which sometimes are generated by coition, sometimes of the putrefaction of the earth. Amongst fowl, geese, ducks, didipers, and all kind of watery fowl as prey upon fish, as the heron, and those that are equivocally produced, as wasps of the carcasses of horses, bees of the putrefaction of cows, small flies of putrefied wine, and beetles of the flesh of asses. But most lunary of all is the two-horned beetle, horned after the manner of a bull, which digs under cow dung, and there remains for the space of 28 days, in which time the moon measures the whole zodiac, and in the 29th day, when it thinks there will be a conjunction of their brightness, it opens the dung and casts it into water, from whence then come beetles. Amongst fish, these are lunary. Elurus, whose eyes are changed according to the course of the moon, and whatsoever observe the motion of the moon, as the tortoise, the echinesis, the crab, oysters, cockles, and frogs. Well, I think there is more of the old auto-generating insects in this. I guess in the older days, they believed that certain rotting elements could produce certain bugs, like the putrefaction and the small flies from putrefied wine, drain flies, right? I guess they were unaware of where they really came from. I think the important thing about the moon in this context is the moon governs change. The moon governs things that go from one state to another. The moon governs things that obviously are watery, that deal with the waters because of the tide, and also travel and things which would take the course along rivers. You know, most roads, especially when you go through the mountains, are based along watercourses because water seeks its own level. It erodes through the landscape and it makes the most easy path. So through the mountains, most throughways are going to be near a stream. This is certainly true also of earlier commerce and settlement of great cities. Obviously, all grain and surplus was produced and shipped via boat. You know, even through the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century, the canals and the narrow boats to bring the coal between the industrial north and England, for example, all along waterways. So the moon governs a change in location, just as it governs a change in appearance. The changeable, the soporific, the internal, the imaginative, the feminine, and the poetic. I think Burns would approve of a lunary enconium on his birthday. Well, thank you for listening this far. I'm going to keep this one short today because I've got a lot going on, of course. And, well, it's Robert Burns' birthday. I don't want to keep you too late either. I hope you're enjoying the Three Books of Occult Philosophy. We've got a long way to go, but we are getting into the planets. Next week, we will be discussing those things that are Saturnine and under the influence of the planet Saturn. It's kind of a bit of a list that we have to go through in the way that Agrippa has put the first book together. But there is a methodical growth to it, right? He has started with the elements. He's gone through the admixtures of the elements and kind of the reasons for them. And now we're getting into the planets. And pretty soon we'll get into the signs. And then we'll get into the more interesting angelic stuff in book two. But certainly this is good background knowledge. And if you, you know, want to skip ahead, by all means, I don't blame you. But I do think it's worth understanding these concepts, even though obviously they're outmoded. The vital principles that Agrippa is trying to espouse, nonetheless, are constant. And when we're looking at this worldview, we're looking at it really to try to shift our worldview so that we can better understand the wisdom of the ancients, because it's all built on this kind of natural philosophy, if you will. It's not what we think of in the reductionist empirical scientific worldview of the modern age, although certainly that empirical modern scientific worldview arose and was inspired from this natural philosophy, especially, you know, where experimentation began to expose the likes of electricity, for example, which we don't completely, I don't think anybody can completely understand electricity. It's kind of a mysterious force. But nonetheless, through empirical experimentation, we can certainly learn how to manipulate and harness it, as we have done. And now it lights the world. Nonetheless, this ancient wisdom, for want of a better word, is eminently applicable even today in the modern era. Well, thank you for listening this far. If you like this episode and you like the Rocky Mountain Mason podcast, please consider becoming a patron. You can visit our patreon.com website through our webpage, rockymountainmason.com. I'd like to thank all the subscribers from the Chicago Masonicon. I apologize for the delay in getting the magazines out to you, but they are in the mail. And issue number 2 of the Esoteric Mason is in production. Until next time, take care and Godspeed.